Today on the show, we are talking about the Australian Iron Dragon, Ferro-Draco Lentini. This episode, I get to do my favourite thing in the world, which is talk about pterosaurs. Specifically, I'm going to tell you about my son, aka Butch, aka Ferro-Draco, the species I named back in 2019. Strap yourself in and get ready for takeoff. Pals in Paleo presents Ferro-Draco. Pals and Paleo acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. This episode was recorded on Koa Country in Winton, central western Queensland, and the holotype and only known specimen of Ferro-Draco was also found on Koa Country. This is Pals in Paleo, the podcast where we fly through the form, function, and family groupings of your favourite fossils. I'm your host, paleontologist, grazier, and all-round Aussie pterosaur enthusiast, Adele Pentland. You can keep up to date with the show and my research by following at Pals in Paleo on Instagram. Before I start throwing Ferro-Draco facts your way, I need to be honest with you. I'm really nervous about doing today's episode. Which is weird to say because I named Ferro-Draco as a new species in 2019, so I know it inside and out. Literally, this is the one topic which I could claim to be an expert on, and yet the imposter syndrome is hitting pretty hard. I guess what it comes down to is that I'm nervous I'll stuff it up. Or, yeah, I'll listen back to this episode later on and I'll absolutely hate it. But you know what? I figured there was no time like the present and I couldn't justify saving it for, like, the 100th episode. Because I love Ferro-Draco so much, I did make a special request to include it in the cover art for the podcast. The very talented team at Crumpet Clubhouse smashed it out of the park. They are at Crumpet Clubhouse on Instagram. That's all one word. And a big special shout out to Jenny who came up with the cover art. You can follow her illustration work at Jenny Z Design. I'll also include links for their social media handles in the show notes. Before we launch into pterosaur talk and facts on the form, function, and family of Ferro-Draco, first things first, it's time for the random fossil fact. Consider this your in-flight safety briefing before takeoff. You know, to prepare you for all the other facts that are going to be flying at you thick and fast. Today's random fossil fact has been stuck in my head since 2015. Back then, I was studying at Monash University doing my honours degree, which here in Australia is a bit like doing a master's research project within the space of 1 year. At that time, my research project was on amber. Anyway, this new company called Biosyn Genetics wanted dino DNA and... I'm just kidding. I was on a mission to find cool stuff trapped in amber, that much is true, and describe it as best I could in my thesis. Anyway, I had never done a research project before, I'd never worked on amber, so I needed to figure out what was common and what was unique. Essentially, I needed to get my head around what other researchers around the world had found in amber. So I spent a lot of time reading through papers, and it was during that time that I found the most unexpected thing. This research was published by Vincent Girard and colleagues in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2008. This team of researchers were working on amber from the Cretaceous of France and found a bunch of microscopic marine fossils in their samples. I'm just going to read a bit from the abstract here because I don't want to get it twisted. Diverse marine diatoms, as well as radiolarians, sponge spicules, a foraminifer, and a spine of a larval echinoderm were found in late Albian and early Cenomanian amber samples of southwestern France. End quote. So, just to repeat the part of the stuff, what I said about the things, that was a Simpsons quote, by the way. Bonus points if you can figure out which episode it's from. So, Girard et al.'s amber is about 100 million years old. So, pretty old. But the marine fossils are basically things that you might find today if you grab some beach sand and looked at it underneath a microscope. In case you have no idea what I'm talking about, picture yourself walking along a beach absolutely covered in shells. Not only are there the shells that you can see, but on the microscopic level, there's even more stuff you can't see with the naked eye. If you've never seen sand on a microscopic level, you're seriously missing out. It's beautiful, but also kind of weird. It's alien. It's otherworldly. My brother got me a really good book on this. If you're interested in seeing exactly what I'm talking about, the book is The Secrets of Sand, A Journey into the Amazing Microscopic World of Sand. I'll put a link to it in the show notes for this episode, including a link to where you can buy it on Amazon. It's not an affiliate link, not fancy enough to know how to set that up, but I thought it would be a little less ambiguous, a little easier this way. Plus, if your local library doesn't have it and you're interested, by all means, go ahead and get yourself a copy. Getting back to the random fossil fact, though, and this weird French amber with the microscopic marine creatures. They didn't just find one type of thing inside their amber. There were multiple inclusions from multiple groups of animals. Altogether, they found sponge spicules, radiolarians, a foraminifer, and the spine of an echinoderm. Echinoderms are the group that include sea urchins, sea stars, brittle stars, sand dollars, sea cucumbers, and sea lilies. These are all animals, by the way. I know the name sea lilies is a bit misleading, as are the Pokemon Lilip and Cradily, which are grass types based on sea lilies, but all echinoderms are animals. Based on the shape of the spine embedded in this 100 million year old amber, it was the larval stage of a sea urchin, so a little baby sea urchin. Now, a sponge is also an animal, even though, yes, it doesn't have organs, a nervous system, or even symmetry. Sponge spicules are either made up of calcium carbonate, which is what seashells are made up of, or they can be made of silica, which is what quartz and sand is made up of. Girard et al. Found both types of spicules in their amber, and identified them based on their shape, which kind of looks like, well, they're like mini wave breakers. You might know what I'm talking about if you played a lot of Animal Crossing New Horizons during the pandemic, like I did. Lastly, radiolarians and foraminifera are single-celled organisms that, along with a bunch of other stuff, make up zooplankton. Again, like everything else I've just mentioned, you only find these types of things in shallow marine environments. So, how did this stuff end up in amber? So, it seems that 100 million years ago, a bunch of trees near the eastern coast of the incipient Atlantic Ocean were oozing with resin. And that resin, while it was still sticky, trapped these marine microorganisms inside, and then that fossilized and formed amber. It is, without a doubt, hands down, the weirdest fossil I can think of, just because I never would have even thought that something like this could come together in this way. I love a good weird fossil, and as I said at the start of the random fossil fact, amber was the first thing I got to work on as a student paleontologist. Now, let's take to the skies and talk more about pterosaurs and my boy, Barodraco. Normally on the show, we talk about the form, function, and family groupings of your favourite fossils and end with a bit of miscellaneous info, but this isn't just another episode. Today's show is on a fossil that I've spent years working on and named with the help of my friends and colleagues. Let me highlight this. Discovering Ferrodraco was a team effort. I couldn't have done the science on this fossil without dozens of volunteers and the folks at the Australian Age of Dinosaurs. We'll be hearing from Bob Elliott, who discovered the Ferrodraco fossil, as well as honorary fossil technician Ali Calvi, who set Ferrodraco free from its rocky prison. Both Bob and Ali also got to be a part of the 2017 dig season and helped excavate this fossil in the field. I wouldn't have had the opportunity to work on this incredible fossil if it hadn't been discovered by Bob Elliott. Bob's parents, David and Judy, started the Australian Age of Dinosaurs Museum of Natural History, so from a young age, Bob has known what dinosaur bone and other fossils look like. Bob has discovered multiple fossil sites, but the site Ferrodraco came from is pretty unique. I caught up with Bob and had a yarn to him about what it was like when he made that discovery.
So I'd gone out there to spray burr. I was expecting a big day there spraying burr. It wasn't as big a job as I thought it was going to be. I was expecting there to be all day, but I had it all finished by 11 o'clock. So I had a little bit of time on my hands. I was at a certain part of the creek where it's a real fossiliferous area. Basically, they had a lot of that silt rock. It just looked like a spot. There's got to be something there. So I went walking up there. And sure enough, went up there 15 minutes, found nothing. I mean, you never do. When you're looking for it, you don't find these things. So I'd pretty much given up and I started walking back down where the four-wheeler was. And it was actually on my way back down into the creek when I came across this piece of bone. It would be about 10 centimetres long. And if you imagine a sheep leg bone that's just been cut in half, that's from a distance, because I saw this thing probably about 3 metres before I came across it. And as soon as I bent down to pick it up, I knew straight away, that's a fossil. I said, no, that's too heavy. It's fully fossilised. This is dinosaur era.
When you find something like that, it's super important to remember to record as much information as possible. If you find something you think might be a site, it pays to mark it in some way and take a GPS coordinate with your phone. Bob has found half a dozen fossil sites and often carries with him the tape surveyors use when they're out on a job and little steel pegs, the kind you'd use to set up a tent when you're camping. So when he came across this site, he marked it and took photos showing what was found and where each bone came from. And this made it a lot easier when a team returned to the site to excavate the area. It's also important to remember, if you find one bone, there's a pretty good chance you'll find more. Here's Bob bringing us back to that eureka moment when he'd made that chance discovery.
And then straight away, you can see that's a small bone. That's not off a sauropod. That's not off anything we find out here usually. So this is exciting. So then I started looking around, and it actually, to be perfectly honest, for the first minute, I did not find anything else. It took me a little while just to get my eye in. And once you got my eye in, I started finding lots smaller pieces and lift up this tussock here, and then you find a little bit more there. And yeah, by about 15 minutes, I'd probably found between 10 to 15 bones.
Like so many of us, Bob learned about pterosaurs as a kid through walking with dinosaurs. I'll talk a little bit about this later, but pterosaurs have hollow bones, which is an evolutionary adaptation that allows them to fly. Unfortunately, that also means that their bones get broken very easily and is part of the reason why they're such rare fossils. Because it's a comparatively complete specimen, Bob rates it as one of his best finds yet, and I have to agree with him on that one. But his love of pterosaurs didn't start with this specimen. In fact, they've always been one of his absolute favourites.
I don't know. I don't think I can top what I found, to be perfectly honest. I mean, as a kid, pterosaurs were always my favourite dinosaurs.
You might have noticed that Bob hesitated a little bit when he called pterosaurs dinosaurs, because he now knows they're not dinosaurs. But when he was younger, he didn't realise they belonged to two separate groups, which is a pretty common misconception. Anyway, that's all I wanted to say on that. Back to the interview.
No, well, they were because, what was it, Walk with Dinosaurs? Was that the TV
Walking
show?
With
Walking with Dinosaurs. That's a show. I loved that as a kid. That came out when I was probably around the 10 to 13 years old. And so it was just fantastic. And there was a series there with Ornithocaris, is that right? Yeah, the pterosaur. And he was my favourite. That was, I watched that series a lot. And so it was my favourite. But I never really dreamed of finding my own because I thought the chances of actually finding something like that is just, oh, come on, that's ridiculous. And to be perfectly honest, when I first found it out in the creek there, I found a piece of bone. And straight away I thought, well, it's not sauropod. It's not Pleistocene. It's not recent. It's old. It's from the dinosaur age. But it's small. What can it be? This is quite interesting. But pterosaur was not something I thought of at all. And it wasn't until looking for around about 10 minutes, I found other little bits of bones, quite interesting pieces. But after a while, I found a piece. It had a little bit of rock around it, so you could only see bone on some sections, but then I noticed teeth sticking out. And these teeth, we're talking quite long, sharp teeth, about 2 centimetres long. And so that was exciting. But straight away I thought, okay, this means fish eater. So I thought, that's marine. It's going to be a lasmosaur or something like that. That's what I thought. It was going to be a lasmosaur. They got nice sharp teeth like that. So that's what I thought I had. I thought I had marine. I thought it was going to be some sort of plesiosaur or lasmosaur, and that's what I had.
As I mentioned before, Bob knows quite a lot about fossils because it's been a big part of his life. Even though he didn't study paleontology at university, I'm the first to admit, sometimes he knows more about fossils than I do, because he has years of hands-on experience. Above all else, Bob is a problem solver. Running a farm isn't easy and stuff breaks down all the time. Even in the most stressful situations, Bob is almost always calm and collected. His logical reasoning, combined with years of experience, led him to the conclusion that this wasn't another sauropod site. But initially, he thought he had a very different type of fossil on his hands. He thought he had discovered some sort of plesiosaur, and it wasn't until he brought the fossil to the museum that we actually worked out what it was.
And the most exciting thing, other than Harry supergluing his finger to his eye, it was going through every bone and then just having a discussion between all of us what it was. Trying to work out what it was, and we came to the conclusion that it just did not look right, or for a plesiosaur or something like that. And I'm pretty sure it was my dad that mentioned pterosaur. As soon as he said that, we sort of all looked at each other and sort of think, ah, didn't think of that. Surely not. Can't be that. And then we started looking online. The more we looked, the more it just looked like pterosaur. Yeah, that was pretty exciting that day when we came to the conclusion it has to be a pterosaur.
Pals and Paleo will be right back. This episode is brought to you by Dinosaur Trips. Dinosaur trips are exactly what they sound like. Each itinerary gets you up close and personal with experts and gives you backstage access into the world of paleontology, visiting museums from across the world, and even getting you onto real-life dinosaur digs. There's a bunch of trips running in 2024. Alberta Badlands and Beyond is back, and so's Badlands Family Adventure. Personally, I'm eyeing off the trip to Arizona and California because I'm dying to see the La Brea tar pits, but then again, I'm also tempted to travel to Patagonia. To learn more about the 2024 trips, you can check out their website, dinosaurtrips.com, and sign up to their newsletter to be the first to find out about the new trips. And you can email Zach on zach@dinosaurtrips.com, and Zach is spelled Z-A-C-H. It's been 66 million years. Why wait any longer? Join Dinosaur Trips on the adventure of a lifetime.
And once Bob found it and we identified it as a pterosaur, it became quite a treasure.
That's fossil preparator and honorary technician with the Australian Age of Dinosaurs, Ali Calvi. I first met Ali on a dinosaur dig on the Victorian coast as part of Dinosaur Dreaming, which I mentioned in episode 2 on Coolosuchus, and I had no idea that we'd cross paths again in Winton. In fact, if you travelled back in time and told me that Ali would be prepping Australia's most complete pterosaur fossil and I would be given the chance to name it, I would have told you you were hepped up on goofballs. Not only did Ali prep the pterosaur, she was kind enough to help me plan my wedding, which was at the museum. Ali is one of the kindest people I know, and it was wonderful to have her prep the pterosaur since she also got to participate in the dig that year. as Ali's quick to point out, the whole team got involved and got behind this incredible discovery.
Several stages occurred before it even came to the lab for me to prep. First of all, there was the finding of it. And I think that is a very special process. People forget that finding things in the field is a methodical process. So when you do start finding these wonderful specimens, you've got to treat them with the utmost respect at every stage. And then it was a case of, well, we had to try and find as much of this material as possible. So we were meticulously looking through the material from the site, and every twig and rock and clump of soil was thoroughly examined. And then we had the washing and sieving. And then Judy Elliott did an amazing job assessing everything that was found, stabilizing it, puzzling it, observing it, and getting it ready for the final prep in the laboratory. So there's a number of different processes that occur before anyone even puts a tool to it.
Being on that dig and having the privilege of naming Ferrodraco is easily one of the best things I've ever gotten to be a part of. It's wild to think that at the time when David Elliott gave me first dibs to work on this fossil, I was literally a nobody. I didn't have a single publication to my name, and I was entrusted with the best fossil pterosaur ever found in Australia. The only thing I had going for me was everyone at the museum knew I was super interested in working on fossils and desperate to get a postgrad position. Working on Ferrodraco absolutely changed my life. And I don't think I would have been given such a massive opportunity if I had stayed in Melbourne, where I grew up. A couple months after Bob found this incredible fossil, we had a team helping dig at the site as part of the Australian Age of Dinosaurs Museum annual dig, and the whole team was buzzing with excitement. Helping run that dig was a pretty steep learning curve because even though I'd done a little dinosaur digging beforehand, it was like getting thrown in the deep end. At the time, I was 23 and altogether had maybe 2 weeks of dig experience, and there were definite growing pains, but I learned so much from that experience. We ended up with 10% of the skeleton, which was a crazy amount when you considered that before this, every other pterosaur fossil in Australia was one bone or a partial bone. At the moment, Ferrodraco is the most complete pterosaur known from Australia, but I reckon it's only a matter of time before we find an even better specimen. The genus name I picked, Ferrodraco, literally means the Iron Dragon, and it's so fitting for this specimen because it's preserved in this gorgeous ironstone-rich rock. I also love the nickname Butch in honour of Butch Lenton, the previous mayor of Winton. But as it turns out, this incredible fossil almost ended up with a very different nickname.
Definitely two names. One was Arthur, the other one was Butch. Butch just sounded perfect. But yeah, no, Butch was a very well-known man in our area who was a great mayor, great fella, and it was really great to remember him in that way.
I can't think of a better way of keeping his spirit alive and paying tribute to him since, yeah, he was, as Bob said, just a great guy, and the community was devastated when he passed away in 2017. The species name, Lentoni, is also in honour of Butch Lenton. So together, the genus and species name means Lenton's Iron Dragon. Before we could name it though, we needed to remove the rock covering the specimen and directly observe every single bone. As you heard before, Ali prepped Ferrodraco and volunteers on dinosaur digs across Australia. Like so many of us, her passion and enthusiasm for scientific discovery is what drives her.
I've got a passion for fossils anyway, and digging, it is just so exciting to be a part of that whole process of discovery. And the prepping is just the next stage.
I personally find it very difficult to prep fossils because I'm a slightly anxious person, and it's really easy for me to get stuck inside my own head and worry and spiral. Part of it is because there's always a chance that you've got something that we've never seen before, and it might be the only one of its kind in the world. Ali sort of thinks the same way, but she's a bit more zen about it and also has a ton of experience when it comes to using the tools in the lab.
Everything deserves respect. Every tiny fragment should be given the same respect as the best specimen you've got, because you just truly do not know what's in there until you start prepping it properly.
I mentioned before that Ali is an honorary technician at the Australian Age of Dinosaurs. Most of the fossil prep in our lab is led by volunteers. Staff guide them and give advice on how to approach each fossil, but there are over 300 honorary technicians on the books, some as young as 12, who spend hours upon hours working on some of Australia's most unique fossils. Since Ali is now based in Winton, she's one of our most dedicated volunteers, but despite spending countless hours in the lab, she's still one of our most enthusiastic fossil preppers.
Every time I drive up to the jumper, I get excited. It is something that I always hoped I might be able to do, but of course I always thought that I might end up going on digs overseas, but of course there is so much going on in Australia that a lot of people, they're not aware of. They don't realise how much science is occurring and the amount of effort that's being put into preserving our ancient history.
The Fossil Prep Lab in Winton is probably one of Australia's best kept secrets. And I mentioned before that Australian Age of Dinosaurs has over 300 honorary technicians. Let me just clarify, they're not all working in the lab at the same time. Think at any one time there's a maximum of 10 people on the tools. The other thing I wanted to mention is that if you're interested in volunteering in the lab or on the digs, I'll put links in the show notes so you can find out more. We have people of all ages volunteer with us and have been even able to convert tourists as they travel through to come back and volunteer in the lab.
A lot of people, when they come through the lab, are just reinvigorated with that enthusiasm for dinosaurs and science and fossils in general. And it's lovely to see it. It's not just kids, it's people of all ages. And they never ever thought they would get a chance to see it. And to participate is just mind-blowing for most people.
For a lot of people who visit the museum, the lab and its volunteers are a highlight. It's pretty special to get to see everyone working away and see some incredible fossil specimens.
People are quite fascinated. They often ask in the lab, how long will it take you to finish that specimen? And you go, I'm sorry, I can't tell you. Because every single specimen has its own difficulty. The smallest thing can take just as long as the side of a well-preserved rib. So you never know until you've finished.
Speaking of small, delicate fossils, I'm biased, but I think it's nothing short of a miracle that Bob found Ferrodraco when he did. The Winton area and other parts of Australia have what's called black soil, which is a self-mulching or rotational soil, which, as the name suggests, moves around because it's super clay rich. It's important for those of us interested in finding dinosaurs and other fossils, because material a couple meters underground eventually works its way up to the surface through that self-mulching process. In Winton, the black soil is basically everywhere except for the jump ups, which is what we call our hills, and the creek systems. And the latter preserves fossils from the Pleistocene. So think of the megafauna, giant kangaroos, Diprotodon, which is the largest marsupial to live, and other bizarre and fantastic creatures. If Ferrodraco hadn't been preserved in that creek, the self-mulching soil would have ground Butcher's bones to dust long before Bob, or anyone else for that matter, had a chance to spot them.
And because these bones are so small, for them to come up through the black soil over thousands of years, it never would have made it. It would have disintegrated, never would have found anything. So, yeah, it's a bit unbelievable, really, to have found something that I loved as a kid. Maybe it still is. I'm not sure. The most complete pterosaur in Australia.
Still is.
It still is, for now.
Oh, yeah, we might find another more complete one. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. Absolutely. I think it's only a matter of time. But they're not going to be easy to find.
Look, we're working on it, but to this day, Ferrodraco is still the most complete pterosaur in Australia. I hope you enjoyed hearing Bob tell us what it was like to find Ferrodraco and Ali's perspective as a fossil preparator. Without them and so many others, our scientific understanding of this specimen would be stuck at square one. We've heard about the discovery of this specimen and a little bit about what went on behind the scenes. Let's talk now about the form, function, and family grouping of Ferrodraco. Since this is the first pterosaur for Pals and Paleo, let's talk first about form before we get into function and family grouping. You might have noticed by now I keep saying the word pterosaur and I don't say the word pterodactyl. Let me be clear on this. Pterosaurs and pterodactyls, they're not the same thing. A pterodactyl is a type of pterosaur, just like roses are a type of plant and dogs are a type of mammal. Pterosaurs are an extinct group of flying reptiles. They lived at the same time as the dinosaurs during the Mesozoic period, making their first appearance in the fossil record at the start of the Triassic. Like dinosaurs and marine reptiles, pterosaurs went extinct at the end of the Cretaceous period when a ridiculously large meteorite, 10 kilometers wide, smacked into the Earth, hitting the Yucatan Peninsula, which is in modern-day Mexico. Fossils of pterosaurs are pretty rare because their bones are hollow, so they stand a better chance of getting broken up before they can even get buried and then turned into a fossil. Pterosaurs have wings, which, like birds and bats, are actually their arms, which have become super specialized over millions of years of evolution. So that's two wings, two legs, a head, and a tail. We tried explaining this to our next door neighbor once over the phone, and in case you're wondering, Del, why would you bother talking to your neighbor by phone instead of just over the fence? It's because this particular neighbor lives 30 kilometers away and I live in the middle of nowhere. Anyway, trying to explain to our neighbor what a pterosaur looks like, and he's been a farmer all his life and he's 80. Now, I'm not trying to diss him. Like, he's very smart, very capable, but he doesn't really know that much about dinosaurs and other prehistoric animals, so he had a bit of trouble trying to picture what a pterosaur looked like. He kept picturing a four-legged animal with a pair of wings coming off the back, so he was essentially thinking of a Welsh dragon. But the problem is, pterosaurs don't look like that. In fact, there isn't an animal alive today that has four legs and a set of wings. So don't picture that. Instead, picture yourself wearing a wingsuit. Speaking of wings, let's actually take a minute now to focus on what the structure of the wing looks like. So a pterosaur wing is closest to the wing of a bat, since both are made up of skin attached to the bones in the hand, and that then extends all the way down to the ankle. So if you were to draw it, you'd be able to see blood vessels through that layer of skin. The biggest difference, though, between a pterosaur and a bat is that bats have 5 digits, and for all intents and purposes, they're about the same size, but pterosaurs only have 4 digits. The first 3 are absolutely tiny, and the 4th basically makes up the whole part of what we think of as the wing. Ferrodraco is a pterodactyloid, which is a group also known as the short-tailed pterosaurs. Pterodactyloids tend to have bigger wingspans, and based on the wing bones that we have in Butch, so that is specifically part of the ulna and radius, as well as what's called the first wing phalanx, the wingspan for Ferrodraco would have been about 4 meters or a little over 13 feet. I feel like if something that big were in the skies today and it dive bombed me, I'd probably duck for cover, into the nearest bush or whatever I could find, basically. Compared to most of the winged animals whizzing around today, that is huge. The only thing that even approaches that size is the wandering albatross, like the largest bird alive today. Unlike the wandering albatross and modern birds, Ferrodraco not only had wings, but a jaw filled with dozens of spike-shaped teeth. Now, not all pterosaurs have teeth. There's a couple famous ones that have beaks, like Pteranodon and Quetzalcoatlus. But when Ferrodraco closed its mouth, the teeth interlocked, so it's kind of like pulling a zipper closed or holding hands with someone and their fingers interlocking with yours. And the big advantage here is that when those teeth close together, they can trap and hold onto slippery fish and squid. Before we talk about function more though, the last anatomical feature I want to talk about is the unique shape of Ferrodraco's head. Lots of pterosaurs in the family Ornithochiridae have a premaxillary crest or bony extension at the tip of the snout. Not all Ornithochirids have this, but most do, and it seems to be something that develops during adulthood. The shape of this feature in general is very unique, and there isn't an animal alive today I can really use as a reference guide. Probably the easiest thing would be to look at the cover art for the podcast. Ferrodraco is in the top right-hand corner. And I'll also post a photo of me holding Ferrodraco to the Pals in Paleo Instagram. If you've seen Walking with Dinosaurs and you remember the pterosaur Tropignathus, it also has a premaxillary crest. In that species, it's a bit more rounded sort of compared to Butch. At this point, you're probably wondering, why would an animal have a head shaped like this? And to be quite honest, paleontologists have been scratching their heads and asking themselves the same question for decades. Initially, it was thought that the shape of the premaxillary crest could be used to help identify different species, but there's been work since then that sort of demonstrates this doesn't really seem to always be the case. So we've talked about form. Let's now talk about function and discuss what we think Ferrodraco was doing in its environment. When biologists and paleontologists struggle to come up with a simple explanation for why an animal might have a somewhat strange appearance, they try and look for other examples. That might be other examples in the animal kingdom, and sometimes it's from their own personal experiences. For me, I know I'll put my hand up and say I have done a lot of cringeworthy things and had some very questionable haircuts because I thought it might impress a boy I had a crush on. That's right. The premaxillary crest in pterosaurs is probably just something flashy for show to attract members of the opposite sex. There's some evidence to suggest that this structure might have also played a role in thermoregulation, so maintaining an animal's overall body temperature. But considering the number of fossils that have been found for this group, and it's relatively high, there's maybe a handful of specimens that seem to preserve little grooves and pits for blood vessels. So this is still very much up for debate. Compared with the premaxillary crest, the other aspects of Ferrodraco's body plan are much easier to understand. Wings aren't good for digging holes, but they allowed pterosaurs to take to the skies, making them the first vertebrates to do so. A pterosaur the size of Ferrodraco, 4 meter wingspan, roughly over 13 feet, they couldn't really climb trees, but they could walk around on the ground with a quadrupedal gait, so on all fours. But the wing wouldn't have been touching the ground. Fossilized pterosaur tracks preserve the first 3 digits on their hand pushing into the ground, but the 4th digit, the wing finger, if you will, is lifted off the ground. Makes sense, right? You don't want to be dragging your wing around when you walk. That'll mess it up and tear the skin. I mentioned before that Ferrodraco and other related pterosaurs have what's called a fish grab dentition, which does what it says on the tin. Grabs fish and other slippery little suckers so they can't escape. Pterosaurs are somewhat infamous swimmers. In fact, the first pterosaur fossils found by white scientists were interpreted as demonic penguins, a description which I stan. I mean, well, birds and pterosaurs are the separate as cats and dogs, but it does conjure up this really nice image of pterosaurs diving through water for fish. So even though having wings for arms probably isn't the greatest when you're trying to swim, Ferrodraco would have been just fine in the water. In fact, this species would have had no trouble launching out of the water and into the air. I'll put a link to a paper on this in the show notes. It's going to be a long, long section for the show notes this episode. Technically, those researchers were studying Anhanguera, a close cousin of Ferrodraco, but it's still an airtight argument. Pun intended. Speaking of Anhanguera, let's now talk taxonomy and try and untangle the mess that is Ferrodraco's family group. Okay, I'm not going to sugarcoat this. Even though, yes, understanding the evolutionary history of fossils is super important and can help us understand the animals around us today, it can be kind of difficult, it can be confusing, and at times, frustrating. In fact, it can be so frustrating that if you catch me on a bad day and say, "What's wrong, Adele?" I'll say something like, "Everything sucks," or "Taxonomy is fake." Of course, it's not fake. It's just a framework we use to try and put things into neat little boxes. Unfortunately, the family groupings of pterosaurs can be difficult to understand. Not all aspects of pterosaur taxonomy are like this, but the branch of the family tree that I predominantly work on definitely is. It's not simple and straightforward. Okay, so I'll try my best to explain this. The big group, and one of the first pterosaur families named, was the Ornithochiridae. And the definition of this group is based on the position of one species of pterosaur, Ornithochirus simus. As you might have guessed, Ornithochirus simus was one of the earliest species of pterosaur named. The problem with it is that it's not the greatest specimen in the world. The fossil is just the very tip of the upper jaw. To make matters worse, there haven't been very good specimens of it found since then. Because this specimen is a partial jaw and nothing else, when we try and include it in a phylogenetic analysis, when we try and piece together the pterosaur family tree, it can jump around a bit in terms of its position, which then messes up our definition of what is the Ornithochiridae and what fits within that family. In fact, more recent work keeps pushing it further and further to the base of the tree. This isn't because there's anything wrong with the new research. On the contrary, each new discovery helps us learn more and more. It's just that Ornithochirus simus is a bit like Vanellope from Wreck-It Ralph. Universally loved, cute, kind of scrappy though, but incomplete and glitching around everywhere. And unlike Vanellope, Ornithochirus simus can't control it. So, yeah. Generally speaking, Ferrodraco belongs to this big group called the Ornithochiridae. Another name that pops up is the Anhanguridae, which is named after a genus of pterosaurs from Brazil called Anhanguera. I mentioned it before. They had that study with the pterosaurs launching out of water. Some researchers have argued in the past that Ornithochiridae and Anhanguridae are basically the same thing, and that the name that we had first, which in this case is Ornithochiridae, was first in line, so it has what's called taxonomic priority. Others argue that Anhanguridae is a group that fits within Ornithocheiridae, which is kind of hard to wrap your head around. So imagine, if you will, a nesting doll situation, but with animal names. So Pterosauria is the big doll. Within that, we have the Pterodactyloidea, or short-tailed pterosaurs. After that, the next smallest one is Ornithocheiridae. That would then be followed by Anhanguridae, and the very smallest doll that doesn't separate out is then Ferrodraco. Now, not everyone in the pterosaur paleontology community agrees on how to use the name Ornithocheiridae. And I feel like we're already getting lost in the weeds of taxonomic discussion, so we'll zoom back out. Regardless of the label on the wine, we can still enjoy it. There's also a couple of things that are constant and mainstays when we figure out what's happening with the family grouping of Ferrodraco. So there is no doubt about it. Ferrodraco belongs to this group. You know what? For the rest of the episode, I'm just going to call it Ornithocheiridae, just to keep it nice and simple. No other reason. Ornithocheirid pterosaurs are mostly found in the early Cretaceous and pop up all across the globe, with lots of fossils found in Brazil, Morocco, China, England, and here in Australia. Generally speaking, pterosaurs in this family are a decent size, with wingspan estimates varying between 4 and up to 8 meters, which is frighteningly large. Just FYI, there are pterosaurs that were even bigger, and yes, I'll definitely be talking about them in a future episode, but today's focus is Ferrodraco. Every time Ferrodraco is included in a phylogenetic analysis, this term I've been bandying about, which is basically a family tree but with animal species instead of Uncle Bob and Aunt Margaret, anytime I or another pterosaur paleontologist puts one of these together and includes Ferrodraco, Ferrodraco ends up next to another Australian pterosaur, Mafunga camara. Mafunga is also from central western Queensland and is just a little bit older. Sometimes these two, the special two, are joined by Tropignathus mesembrinus from Brazil, again made famous by Walking with Dinosaurs, and sometimes the dynamic duo are joined by another Aussie pterosaur, Tabunaga shorai. This phenomenon of the Australian pterosaurs grouping together led another Aussie paleo, Tim Richards, to the theory that there's been an endemic radiation of Australian pterosaurs within Ornithocheiridae. So that would mean that some ancestral Ornithocheirid migrated over to Australia, and its descendants then lived in the central western Queensland region for millions of years, evolving and separating off into different species. Which is kind of interesting, since these pterosaurs were clearly incredible at flying, and yet the science seems to suggest that they weren't migrating across the globe if they didn't have to. Of course, when we find more fossils, we'll get a clearer picture of what's going on and see whether this theory holds water. Last thing before we wrap up, miscellaneous info. As you might have guessed from the random Vanellope von Schweetz reference, I'm a big pop culture nerd and love when there's a crossover between fossils and toys, movies, you name it. Since Ferrodraco was named in 2019, it hasn't clocked in any TV or movie appearances, so there's no Ferrodraco IMDb profile. That said, to the delight of my mum, Ferrodraco has its own Wikipedia page. Like, I cannot tell you how excited she was for me. To her, that was when I'd made the big leagues. Like, forget having a verified social media handle with a blue tick. My name on a Wikipedia page that wasn't written by me? To her, that was like I had transcended and become like a legit researcher. For me, though, when they make a Ferrodraco Yowie, that'll be the moment when I consider myself to have peaked as an Aussie paleontologist. Like, put that on my tombstone. I would die happy if my boy, Butch, was immortalized in plastic and packaged up with foil and chocolate. I think Yowie did make a generic pterosaur when they released the Extinct Animal series. I think it was called Lost Kingdom or something like that. But yeah, if you're listening and you work for Cadbury or you know someone who can make this ridiculous dream of mine a reality, please get in touch. I will drop everything to make it happen. Anyway, maybe one day that'll exist. But until then, I should probably finish telling you where else you can find Fro Draco. You can find today's pterosaur and other fossil friends from the Winton region featured in the picture book Gordo the Guardian by Inga Daniels. You can follow them and see more of their illustration work on Instagram at _ Inga Daniels, all one word. I'll put links to their stuff in the show notes so you can check it out, and a link to buy Gordo the Guardian from the Australian Age of Dinosaurs online shop. It's the only place you can get it. Seriously considering myself getting signed up as an affiliate with the sheer number of books I'm recommending this episode alone, my goodness. Last but certainly not least, probably the biggest thing that's happened since naming Fro Draco is that it was included in last year's Australia Post stamp series. My boy Fro Draco is giving off big main character energy. Like, of the 5 prehistoric animals featured, Fro Draco is smack bang in the middle. I love how it turned out, and I got paid to do scientific consulting work on this project. I was absolutely stoked to work with Peter Trussler. Like I said in the Koolosuchus episode, he brings fossils back to life through his paintings. They are that good. I do eventually want to do an episode on what it was like to do scientific consulting on the AusPost Dino Stamp series, but only if that's something you want to hear. So let me know if it interests you. You can DM me on Instagram at palsinpaleo and I will make it happen. I really hope you enjoyed this episode. I had a lot of fun putting this one together and sharing what I've learned over the years about this incredible fossil I was lucky enough to work on. I've got a few more things up my sleeve research-wise on Fro Draco, but it's very much a work in progress at the moment, and I won't really be able to share anything with you until the paper is finished and appears online. I'll give you a little hint though, it does have something to do with the new research lab I've just joined over at Curtin University. Anyway, only time will tell, but for now, you'll just have to wait and see. A transcript of today's episode and all previous episodes is online. You can find that plus a list of resources related to today's episode in the show notes and links to the other random things I've mentioned today, like the Crumpet Clubhouse, social media handles, they'll be there too. There's lots of people to thank in this episode. Of course, I couldn't have done this research and this episode without the amazing team at the Australian Age of Dinosaurs Museum of Natural History. Literally, I wouldn't be half the paleontologist I am today had I not moved across the country to work there, you know, all those years ago. There's a few folks at Age of Dinosaurs that really showed me the ropes and gave me the opportunity to work on this incredible fossil. The Elliott family, front and center, David, Judy, Bob, and Harry. For years, they've helped work with paleos and allowed them access to their sheep and cattle station. Special thanks to my mentor, Trish Tricky Sloan, my PhD supervisor, Dr. Steve Poropat, my old workmates, George Sinapius. I know that a few of the puns would have made you laugh, George. And Rumbo, aka Stephen Rumbold, and the rest of the Age of Dinosaurs team. Also, it's worth noting that without Age of Dinosaurs, the papers on Fro Draco would be behind a paywall. So massive thanks to Age of Dinosaurs for paying the publication fees, keeping these papers freely available and in open access. You can look them up online, just Google Fro Draco into either Google or Google Scholar, and they'll be there somewhere. Otherwise, again, they'll be in the show notes. Thank you to our incredible team of volunteers. I forgot to mention this, but our dig crews with aged dinosaurs mainly consist of citizen scientists. They pay to come out there and they do a lot of the hard work, busting their humps while we're off collecting data, trying to organize things, doing other bits and pieces. So shout outs to Milton, Pam, Cheryl, Mary, Jen, Joe, Di, Ruben might have been there as well, and everyone else who helped dig at the pterosaur site, wash the matrix that we dug up there using the super sieve. Again, you guys helped so much. Thanks to Swinburne University of Technology and Curtin University for having me as a PhD student and supporting my research. I wouldn't have been able to get it together without these two organizations. Also, thanks to the Australian Research Training Program, the fee offset scholarship I received as a student has made my life so much easier. Thanks as always to Caesar for editing the show and making me sound smarter than I actually am, and hello Kelly for the twinkly nostalgia-soaked tunes. If you like the theme song for Pals in Paleo, there's a mighty high chance you'll love their song Sweet Nostalgia, which you can find on their website and on Spotify. Also, just want to thank the lead singer of Hello Kelly, Francie, for all our other tunes. Hope you enjoyed this one, and I hope I've convinced you to join Team Pterosaur. If you have questions about Ferrodraco or you want to know what it's like to run a fossil dig, you can ask me on Instagram. I'm at Pals in Paleo. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, keep your head in the clouds and your hands in the dirt.